KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Law for the People Convention from October 31st through the 4th at the Benson Hotel in Portland. Registration is now open for this five-day conference. Panels and workshops include Facing Fascism, What's the NLG's Role in Defending Resistance to Fascism? Movement Lawyering for Racial Justice. Disaster Capitalism, Colonialism and Climate Change. What it means to do movement legal support in indigenous communities, and much more. Again, registration is now open for the Law for the People National Lawyers Guild Convention from October 31st through the 4th at the Benson Hotel, 309 Southwest Broadway in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO hosts a monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater called KBOO at the Clinton. This month, on Thursday, October 11th at 7 p.m., we'll celebrate Dia de los Muertos. Muertos Film and Music Night will highlight some of the Dia de los Muertos traditions of Mexico, Central and South America. We'll screen authentic Day of the Dead short films and feature live performances by Virginia Lopez, Mariachi Portland, and more. Again, that's a film celebration of Dia de los Muertos, Thursday, October 11th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. It's just after 9 a.m. on Pacific Underground. Jake and Jenna speak with Visibility Project co-curator Neil Aitken. Attend Valley Views talks with activists with SEIU Oregon Care Works about their leading edge work in the long-term care economy. We'll round out that hour with Flashpoints, generously shared with us our siblings in struggle in Berkeley at KPFA. At 11, a Radio Geekly reports back from convention season, plus insight on spooky happenings to check out this fall. And all of these KBOO programs are only possible with support of the KBOO Foundation members. For those of you who have not yet become members of the KBOO Foundation, you can correct that oversight at kboo.fm. Click on the word donate.
You're tuned in to KBOO Community Radio, and this is Pacific Underground. I'm Jenna, and I am joined by Jake. Good morning, Jake.
Good morning.
How are you doing today?
I'm good.
It's early.
Yeah.
It's early for us people who stay up into the wee hours of the night.
Playing Mahjong.
Yeah. This is what we do on Pacific Underground. We are so API forward that we skip out on sleep to play Mahjong for you.
Only recently, because we're making up for lost time.
The community. Yeah, we're going to get into that today. We're going to talk about how Jen and Jay play Mahjong. But even more importantly, we're going to be talking to Neil Aitken today. Neil is our friend. He is an author. He is a poet.
He's
a community builder. Yeah, he lifts up the API community, the POC community here. If you are a writer here in Portland, you know Neil. You've probably walked through his Decanon space at Milepost 5. You've probably consulted with him. You've probably had laughs and maybe a Mahjong game with him. So we have Neil Aitken here in studio with us to talk about everything he's up to and everything he does with us, which is, well, playing Mahjong. Thank you, Neil. Welcome to you.
It's good to be here.
So if you are a regular listener to KBOO and you're one of those people who keeps the radio on for all hours of the day, then you also know Neil as the host of Lit Fantastic. When does that play, Neil, here in KBOO? You're a late nighter.
Plays Mondays.
Yeah, Mondays.
Runs 10 p.m. first Monday every month.
And it's a poetry show where you interview poets, yes, and authors?
This season it's a poetry show. We interview authors about their obsessions and we basically let that conversation go wherever it goes. Sometimes it's about writing, and sometimes it's about collecting ugly jewelry. never know.
Sometimes it's about Colonel Sanders.
Oh, yes. We began the season with an interview with John Tribble over at Crab Orchard Review, and talked about we talked about his obsession with writing about his teenage years working in KFC in the South. And when he was working there, it was the same time as Colonel Sanders was still alive and would make sudden, unexpected visits pop up, kind of like Second Coming style, in people's restaurants to surprise them and inspect them.
We can get all talk more about the Colonel Sanders, because if people recognize Neil and Aki's name and stuff, also because you're big fans of the API community here, you'll know that actually how Neil and I first kind of like started to get to know one another is we actually worked on the Lit Fantastic before it became a radio show when it was a podcast, and I actually I edited that episode of the Colonel Sanders. That was my last show that I edited, and it was so much fun. So we'll get into a little bit about Neil's show and about why Colonel Sanders maybe should creep us all out just a little more.
A little more.
Than we already were.
I mean, it already does.
But yeah, before we get into like all the Neil stuff, I just kind of wanted to, you know, see, check in on how our Pacific Underground crew is doing. If you tuned in last week, it was Asian Femme Time. And it was me and Tabitha, and we just sort of talked about life. And so for our listeners who have been concerned, we'll just say that Tabitha's partner, Bean, that's his pseudonym on the show, Bean. Bean and Tabitha are doing just fine. If you want to know why you're wondering that, tune into last week's show, because it's really funny. Yeah. So Bean, thanks for being...
A good sport.
You're also, you know.
What does that even mean? Good sport.
It means that me and Tabitha did a little bit of calling out of man trash on the air, and
people got vulnerable. It was
we got vulnerable, and you know what? Apparently, he wasn't like man fragility about it, so that's why we say he was a good sport, because otherwise it could go.
The bar is low.
Yeah, the bar is low
for male fragility.
So yeah, we just want to thank all of our listeners who gave us really good feedback on that, and that apparently people enjoyed listening to me and Tabitha dish about TMI.
Yeah.
Just TMI. So thanks, everyone, for our experiment and seeing what people thought. And apparently, y'all have some life issues, too. So thanks. Thanks for having us not feel so alone. And then what else has been going on in the life of Jake and Jenna and Tabitha and Kat and V? We got the whole collective going on.
Yeah.
We just had so much stuff. Oh, last night we went to the Chinatown Museum.
Oh, right.
Where Tabitha is a volunteer at. And they have this exhibit called, was it Descendant Threads?
Descendant Threads, yeah.
It's really cool. Want to talk a little bit about like what you saw there, Jay?
Yeah. The artists were Roberta Wong, Lynn Yarn, and I forget the third person's name, which like somebody's going to kill me. But we'll come back with that. And it was very interesting. There was a multimedia installation. There was an altar for Vincent Chin, which I found, you know, very, very
touching. That piece was really difficult to look at. Yeah. It was really interesting because it had, like, a picture of Vincent Chin resting on top of a baseball bat.
Mm. And a bunch of Hot Wheel cars.
Yeah, and a bunch of Hot Wheel cars. And then behind it was, like, a kind of like a scroll that had all the events of how Vincent Chin died. And it was... so painful to look at, just so incredibly painful, but so powerful, you know, so incredibly powerful. So I really appreciated that piece. And then we just had like a lot of Portland in there, because it was about, you know, the Chinatown, Japantown. Don't forget that, people here in Portland.
It's not
that
just Chinatown.
It was first Japantown.
And there was also a Manila town in there.
Yes.
It's been erased, but.
Yeah,
you know.
And like there was artist Lynn Yarn, who is Japanese, a Chinese American. And so her heritage, you know, really reflected that in her piece. Mm-hmm. And both of her families have been here in Portland for a long time. So she had this piece where she had pictures from her families, from like multiple generations of her family, like here in Portland. And it was just so.
Both the
incredible.
Chinese and Japanese.
Yeah,
sides.
So
it's
incredibly
deep ties to
interesting.
The community.
Yeah, so I really. Really am digging what Chinatown Museum is doing. Yeah, so keep it up. Keep it up. As if we're doing We're like, good job, you guys need our support. But hey, no, they totally don't, because when we went there, it was like really busy and stuff.
Yeah, they had a lot of good attendance. And I hear last week there was a fundraiser there with Joe Kai, friend of the show, performing,
yeah.
And Jenny Chu. They did a poetry and music piece together, and I was sad to miss out on that, but I hear it went really well.
Yeah, go everybody. It's kind of funny, though. It was one of those events like where, you know, the API community here in Portland is, we're small.
We're spread out.
I don't want to say tiny, but we're small. We're small. It could be smaller. So, you know, we're not tiny, we're small. But yeah. When you know, we know like half the people when we show up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's also kind of cozy in that way where you're like, hey, there's everybody we know. So if you haven't checked that out, get over to the Chinatown Museum and support.
Yeah, I'm definitely planning on going back because the multimedia installation had some audio with all the crowds there. I wasn't really able to listen to it, but...
yeah, just really... really powerful things. Also, sorry, like I'm like totally going because I'm like every piece, like I just stood there getting really sucked in. There was this one that was like 400 little like origami boats basically have been folded, and they were made out of this like Chinese dictionary, you know, because everyone was talking about their identity and talking about their past and like just so amazing. So amazing. I wish I was so talented. So, but talking about other talented people,
guest,
let's talk about Neil. Neil, good morning. Good morning to you. Thank you very much again for coming in today and for talking to us about all the stuff that's going on. So, Neil, right now you have this big thing going on.
To manterrupt you.
Oh, here's some manterruption. Let's see what's going on.
Before we get into it, I was hoping to read a little bit of Neil's bio here because there's a lot of stuff. So Neil Akin is the author of two books of poetry, The Lost Country of Sight from Anhinga Press 2008, which won the Philip Levine Prize, and Babbage's Dream from Sundress Publications 2017, as well as a chapbook of poetry, Leviathan, from Hyacinth Girl Press 2016. He's also the founding member of Boxcar Poetry Review, and his own poems have appeared or forthcoming in the Adroit Journal, American Literary Review, Crab Orchard Review, and many others. He was born in Vancouver, BC, which is a large Chinese community, which we can talk about later. Neil also grew up
in the other Vancouver.
He also went around to Saudi Arabia, Taiwan, and various parts of the Western U.S. and Canada, his Great Plains. The first book explores the themes of home, exile, and return through the lens of memory and forgetting. While the second book draws a lot about the history of the computer and his previous life as a computer programmer and 19th century mathematician Charles Babbage, and we'll plan to get into that later. Neil moved up here after finishing up a PhD in literature and creative writing from University of Southern California, really good program, and MFA in creative writing from UC Riverside, as well as a bachelor's in computer science and math from BYU. So a lot of things to get into.
Dude, he's a translator. That was a good manterruption. That was a good reason to manterrupt.
It was worth it that time.
Right? It sounds so formal. I mean, I wonder who wrote that.
Did you write that?
I think I probably wrote that.
So that's all the things about Neil. Neil has a very impressive background, and it just gives him such a interesting breadth of work. We'll get into the Babbage because I can't wait to talk about Babbage. I'm very fascinated by Babbage because I had no idea who Babbage was. And for many of our listeners who are listening right now, they're like, who is Babbage? And I'm going to tell you, Neil's got interesting
And most people
to
would say.
Say,
what does this 18th century English guy have to do with Asian American history? Well, you know, a lot, apparently.
We're going
to
get into all, we're like building up this Babbage thing so much. But because at first I want to get into what Neil is currently doing here in Portland with your big Decanon project down at Milepost 5. They're off of 82nd out there. Over where all the Asians be hanging out. Yay.
Yeah, where all the boba shops everything are.
Yeah, just because, I'm feeling that today. Where I'm just like, man, Kebu is so inner. We need to have a little API studio out by 82nd. Kebu, open an API studio for us out there. Thanks. Maybe at the Decanon space. So, Neil, for anybody who hasn't been to your Decanon space right now at Milepost 5, can you explain what's going on there?
So Decanon, or Decanon Visibility Project, is a collaboration between me and another local API poet and writer, an artist and musician, Dao Strom. And the two of us came up with the idea a couple years ago That it might be very cool to have a library that showcased work entirely of writers of color. So the DCannon space at Milepost 5 is the, I'd say it's near the end culmination of sort of the form that we hoped it would take. We have an installation that features over 500 books. They're housed in these handcrafted wood casings or slip cases that were fashioned by Dow's partner Kyle from recovered wood. And we have seating, very comfy seating for like living room style. We have spaces for workshops and writing classes. We host White Noise on from time to time for poetry readings. And we also partner with other organizations for reading groups and other events in the space. So the place is intended to be a reading room and also to be a space of learning and community building. We're open Monday through Thursday, usually from about 12 or 1 to around 6.
And sorry to interrupt again, but one thing I found fascinating about the sort of the setup of the DCannon library is that not only does it decenter the idea of a white male canon, but also like the structure with all the little shelves are also very decentralized and sort of resistant to kind of formality. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean one of the things that arrived out of the design of the project was by going to these different sized bookcases and slipcases, it really limits the ordinary organizing factors that we use to arrange things. So normally we think of like a library being arranged alphabetically by last name, or we might have it grouped topically or thematically, or we might group things by country of origin or language. But with the way that the bookcases are set up, all that's relatively impossible to achieve. Instead, it's based on the actual size and dimensions of the book, and to some degree, what looks good next to another book the same size. And all this means that when you go looking for something, you almost always find other things you did not know you were looking for in that process. So there's always a bit of a search, a bit of a hunt, with unexpected treasures along the way. It is a little bit frustrating, I will admit, when someone says, "Do you have this book?" And I know it's in the collection, and then I have to somehow recover from my spatial memory approximately where it is in the collection, knowing that most likely someone's reshelved it and moved it completely away into a different part of the collection.
I've done that a couple times, and yes. You're like, "Where did you put this?" I'm like, "Oh, yeah, sorry."
I just don't try to reshelve. I just stick it on the table, so I apologize. Or I'm awesome. I can't figure out which one it is, because I always feel bad that I don't reshelve it.
No, it's fine not to reshelve. Okay.
But at least you're not reshelving it wrong, like
yeah.
I am.
Yeah, yeah. Some of our volunteers who have started to call themselves librarians.
Nice.
I think they should claim that. So some of our librarians will actually pull out a stack of books that they're reading and just leave them in a stack in a location in the library so that they can return to them.
So how long have you been there at Milepost 5 with this DCannon project?
So we started off the summer about mid-May, I think it was. We set up, and we intended only to be there for the summer. And over the course of the summer, there were things that changed at Milepost 5, and an opportunity arose where we could negotiate a longer stay. And so it became through to September and then through October. And currently we have negotiated through end of November with a strong likelihood we will continue past that.
Oh, it's really exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah, because if you've never been to the space, I really liked it when I first walked in, because it doesn't just look like a room with a row of books. Like, yeah, there's the boxes, but you also have this exhibit of photos. Mm-hmm. That's also up. So it really helps to break up the space and to bring this very, I don't know, it's an artistic feeling when you walk mm-hmm. in.
It's not purely textual.
There's yeah, it's like, not just like you walk into a library. You really mm-hmm. feel like you're walking into an experience. And I really appreciate that, because, this is Portland, so we really appreciate our, POC-centered spaces. And so it's just such a like a feeling to walk in for, you know, those of us who are constantly being inundated with Portland-ness. I was really surprised when the first time I saw the shelves of books, or if you want to call them the boxes of books, and to realize, like, oh, wow, that's not that... At first I thought, that's not that many books, because you're used to, like, walking into, say, like, Multnomah, like, Central Library or something. And then I realized, oh, wait, actually, that's a ton of POC authors. And then there's, like, these kind of mixed feelings where you're like, oh, man, there's all POC authors. That's so exciting. And you see them all together, and you're like, oh, that's not too many. And then it brings up so many of those questions of what Neil, I think, is trying to help, like, bring discussions about and bring attention to, which is, like, you know, around, like, gatekeeping and who gets to be published and who are the authors and what gets to be published and, like, what that discussion is. And so it's interesting then when you go through the shelves and here you have what is in common is, hey, here's POC-ness, right? Common between the authors, and then to see what everybody's talking about and to sort of see this kind of common thread running through so many of the works, right? About, like, identity and just about place and otherness. And it just kind of makes me feel like, I haven't read all these
and
books,
I never had
but
those
I'm in
books
there someplace.
Up, you know?
Neither did I.
Yeah, I think if you're feeling that, then we're succeeding. I should definitely, you know, thank Apano and the Placemaking Grant, which enabled us this year to expand and to basically double the size of the collection. And in keeping with sort of the themes of placemaking, we definitely wanted the space to feel like a type of home that you could come into and feel comfortable, you know, being in, and at the same time it be a showcase not just of literary work but also of visual arts that reflect experiences and you know ways of seeing the world from the POC community. The work, I think for me what's endlessly fascinating is the breadth and diversity of work even within sort of an exhibit or a collection that's based around the idea of collecting the work by writers of color, that there's what is the through line through that. There are assumptions we make going into it, and then they're constantly being shattered and exploded. And I think that's the joy of it, is that even coming into this space or going into the project, we have our own thoughts about, like, what constitutes a writer of color. Like, who is a writer of color? What is an experience that, you know, are there uniform experiences or there is a diversity of experiences? Is there a complexity that we often overlook? Because we assume, like, when we take an Asian American lit class or we take some sort of diverse writers seminar, that we're basically being fed a particular narrative or a particular its own little mini canon of, like, these are the representative experiences, when in fact there may be completely different experiences out there that we haven't read yet.
Right. It's like that, there's that TED Talk by novelist Chimamanda Adichie, that talks about the danger of a single story when you're talking about marginalized communities that essentializes the experience into this one thing, right? Like, if you're only talking about Black writers, you only talk about slavery. Or if you're only talking about, you know, Vietnamese authors, you're talking about, like, the war or something like that. And I found fascinating that there was just this breadth of, like, genre. There's graphic novels. There's nonfiction books. I recently read, when I was there this past Monday, I got just sort of lost in reading the memoir, The Best We Could Do by T. Bowie, and wasn't expecting to find that, but it just kind of found me. So, you know, like, any day, you go in there, you don't know what you're going to kind of, like, come across, which I thought was really neat.
One thing I also find interesting kind of in the opposite way is that, like, yeah, we always say there shouldn't be, like, one story because that gets really frustrating, you know? But it is interesting when you do see multiple authors of similar backgrounds who are telling that, you know, your community story, but they are able to tell it in such a personal way where you're like, oh, wow, there's more than one way to tell this story. Because often, yeah, it's easy to get stuck in the kind of larger narrative that we all, like, know about. Like, you know, when I think of, like, Japanese-Americanness, we always talk about the camps and we talk about this. And there's those similar things we can talk about. But I really love when you come across those like books or those works of poetry that really hone it to be really personal. Mm-hmm. So you're like, oh, you're talking about that general story that everybody knows about. But like when you're given that space to be like, well, let's talk about how this is about me. Mm. And she's like, oh,
the specific details.
This is so good. And so that's one thing I really like about you bringing all these works together. It's like, yeah, we do all end up kind of talking about like our history sometimes when we talk about identity and whatever. But when you're given the space to just say like, here's how it's shaped me, then you really feel that like visibility and stuff like that. Like, oh, such good stuff. Oh, by the way, if you're just tuning in, you are listening to Pacific Underground, and today we're talking to author, poet, organizer, all around awesome Portland supporting everybody. We owe him so much, Neil Akin. he's like, wow, that's quite an introduction. Yes, it is, Neil. We have high expectations.
The bar is high today.
It's actually, Neil, that you just do so much. We're like always amazed by how much you're doing. I'm just like, what, Neil?
I was like, wait, Neil's involved with that too?
I know.
My
I
goal,
like, Neil, when do you sleep?
I wonder that sometimes. My goal is to be Forrest Gump of the Asian American and POC community in Portland.
Oh my goodness. I'm just imagining you like growing out the hair and you're like running and we're like, how are you doing it all, Neil?
No, you just see my name everywhere. No, I think there are a lot of models that I see, people that have been involved in creating community and building these type of projects that I look to as sort of examples of how to do it. I definitely feel like I'm influenced a lot by the years I spent at Kundiman as a poet in their Asian American poetry retreat, and catching
for those
that,
who maybe don't know what Kundiman is, could you give like a little description of what it is?
So Kundiman is an Asian American literary organization headquartered out on the East Coast. They run every summer, they run a about like a 4 or 5 day long writing retreat. Originally it was just poetry, now they have poetry and fiction retreat with occasionally a nonfiction component. And what's great about it is that it's very cost effective. It's, I think, still about $300 for registration, which includes room and board. You often spend more money getting there than you actually do there. And the workshops are generative, but also critique oriented. You see, I think what I loved about it was the sense that you came away not just with writing peers, but a sense of a family that you didn't know you always had. And at the same time, a greater awareness of sort of the breadth and diversity of ways of writing while still having, you know, finding a place under the larger umbrella of being Asian American. So often I think we go into, and I don't think this is just an Asian American experience, but so often when you set out to write, you think about writing about your experiences or your identity or your history, and you look to the models that are available, and you think back, if you took an Asian American lit class or if you read an anthology of Asian American work, and that largely defines how you think about where you fit in. And if you don't feel like you fit into those narratives or those experiences or those writing approaches, then you feel that you are alienated and outside. When I went to Kundiman, I realized that a lot of us felt exactly the same way, and that anxiety about where we would fit in or what we were doing and how we might be deviating from expected or conventional approaches, it was liberating to see that I wasn't alone. In fact, it gave me permission to take on, you know, projects that ordinarily, you know, someone who's Asian American might not see themselves doing.
So before you went to Kundiman, do you feel like maybe you felt stifled as a writer? Like you needed that kind of permission? Like
you were already kind of involved in the Southern California lit scene at that point, right?
Somewhat. I'd spent like about 4 or 5 years in the open mic poetry scene, and I just started an MFA at Riverside at that point. I actually went in not certain what, if anything, I would get out of the experience. I was encouraged by one of my classmates to apply. The moment I got accepted and I said yes, I felt this twinge of like fear that I had just set myself up to be exposed as like not sufficiently Asian American. I was like, I'm half Chinese, Scottish from Canada, and they said yes to me. Clearly, there's something wrong with their process.
It's like that Groucho Marx, I wouldn't join any club that would accept me as a member kind of thing.
There was a little bit of that. There was a little bit of that. And the funny thing was the following year, Matt Oldsman, who's a quarter Filipino, said he had exactly the same experience when he was coming in to Kundiman, and he saw me in the airport. He didn't know that I was a poet, and but he looked at me, and this was back when we were in Charlottesville and University of Virginia before it went to the Bronx, or Queens. I'm forgetting where it is. It's now New York. But the so he looked over in the airport, and he saw me, and he said, "That guy looks vaguely Asian. I bet you he's also going to Kundiman. If he can go, then it's probably okay for me." And he shared that with us at the opening circle, and we just laughed because it was just funny because so many of us have had that experience. And I think especially people of mixed race, you know, are always apprehensive about, like, am I taking up space that could belong to someone else?
And you weigh
your options, because sometimes you do need to step aside and say, like, someone else needs the space more than me.
Mm. Yeah, I'm always aware of that as a sort of half Filipino and then somebody who benefits from light skin privilege. You know, like, there's a lot of colorism in our communities. And so, I constantly have to wonder if I'm Asian enough, but also check myself to be like, well, am I taking up space with my, you know, mixed feelings when there's somebody who's less privileged?
Mixed feelings. Nice one. Yeah.
Ayo.
I'll be here all week, folks.
So we're going to take a quick music break to actually feature another API artist who is not here in Portland, but is going to be in Portland soon, the band No No Boy. And they just released an album called 1942. You can find it on Bandcamp. You go on to nonoboy.bandcamp.com and you'll find their latest album. And No No Boy will be here on October 20th. We'll give more details. But they just, if you haven't heard of No No Boy, it is a collaboration between two artists who write music that's based on their project where they're going to the different Japanese American concentration camps. And so, they've been writing these songs during their journey, and it's part of a larger project that they're working on. And so this song that we're going to be featuring right now is called Instructions to All Persons, which is that opening line from the
executive order.
Yeah, the order that ordered all the Japanese Americans to get out. So Instructions to All Persons by No No Boy.
Instructions to all persons of Japanese. Instructions to all persons of Japanese ancestry. Instructions to all persons of Japanese. Instructions to all persons of Japanese ancestry. I think of my friend Sachi, now Mrs. Kuwatani, telling me stories in the old folks' home. Like the time she was a little girl, climbed above the rest of the world, scaled the tower at the Santa Anita racetrack. We're not even the boys that go. And she felt good for a moment or so. My friend Todd, fishing scorpions from the heart, Colorado River, Indian land, would be Casanova, walking three girls home from the dance. Well, after midnight, singing harmony. So one by one they'd leave and leave tots. Stroll back in the moonlight, singing ballads to the stars all his own. And he felt good. Instructions to all persons of Japanese. Instructions to all persons of Japanese ancestry. Instructions to all persons of Japanese. Instructions to all persons of Japanese ancestry.
I love that one. Maybe it's just because I'm Japanese and I'm a little biased there. I don't know, but it's just, you know, we don't really hear a lot of like modern songs necessarily about that topic, about Japanese American like concentration camps. So it's really interesting to hear like modern songs. So if you've never heard of Nono Boy, that was Nono Boy. Glad to introduce you to Nono Boy. Nono Boy is actually a collaboration between two people, Julian Sepridi and Aaron Aoyama. And again, they're going to be here in Portland on October 20th, and they'll be playing at 7 p.m. at Oregon Buddhist Temple, and you can find them on the socials at Nono Boy. And that's, yeah, I love it because they do like pictures and they do all these songs that they've written while they're at the different camps and stuff. And while that song was playing, actually, and our mics were off, we were talking a little bit about how I find it really interesting why I chose Nono Boy. Well, one's because they're coming, and we're very excited that they're coming here to Portland. We wanted to feature their music and their new album, 1942. But also that my personal fascination with how non-Japanese API in the United States often know more about Japanese-American concentration camps in that time period, and that there's like a fascination with it oftentimes, because growing up it was something we talked about in my family, but it was nothing like very academic that we spoke about. It was just like whatever facts my grandparents told, which was very, very little, right? And then like growing up, and especially in meeting Jake, I found like tons of people who knew so much about this period of history in a way that was very academic, that was very studied, that I never ever felt the need to research. And so I find it just interesting that both Jake and Neil are people who tell me facts about my community's history, because my community doesn't tell me, but other API folks do. And I'm kind of curious, just for like a second, what is y'all's fascination? Like, how did you, why do you feel that, I don't know, maybe you're kind of drawn to the topic? Like, even though it's not like necessarily your personal history, do you feel like a connection to that topic?
Well, I grew up in Idaho, so I try to find any connections to sort of Asian American communities that have sort of like disappeared, or a history of displacement, because before I started doing research on sort of on the Japanese American internment and kind of Chinese displacement, I didn't realize that at the, you know, right before the turn of the century, the Asian American community in Idaho was 1/3 of the total population. And what? After a series of kind of racial violence, like that went down to 1%. And so wow. Like it's that sort of same kind of attitude of deep-seated racism, yeah, that spawned the internment camps, and that sort of like colored a lot of my experience growing up. Colored, heyo. Anyways, that sort of like you want to contextualize your experience, and you know, I wasn't intending to sort of like break down the Japanese community's experience in a very cold kind of dehumanizing way, but at the same time, you know, I had a lot of curiosity about it, and I had friends, Japanese American friends, that have family experiences, you know, from Idaho there, that you know, they don't talk about a lot, but it's definitely...
If people were wondering, like, why is Jenna bringing all this stuff? Also, it's just that my friendship with Jake, he's also introduced a lot of poetry to me because I'm not, like, a big poetry person, apparently, until I met Jake. And just found so much poetry that you've shown me from, like, people's experiences within camps and stuff like that. And I just Uncle Cooney, yeah.
Brian Tomy Dempster.
Yeah, I have a dog named Cooney, and we found that he wrote poems about a guy named Cooney. We're like, oh, wow. But just, he's probably like, oh my God, you guys just compare my uncle to your dog.
Sorry, Brian.
I just thought it was kind of funny. But yeah, it was just these kind of connections that I didn't like really realize that were out there, or just because I always saw that story as just like my family story, not realizing how that period of history is like this kind of tangible thing to many people in the API community, as because we're always told as the model minorities, you know, especially if you're like East Asian, that like everything's fine and everything's always been fine, you know, like well, the Exclusion Act isn't happening anymore, you're allowed here, everything's fine, which I will argue about that Exclusion Act, but yeah, that it's something that as an API community we can really tangibly point to. Mm-hmm. And be like, you imprisoned people.
Well,
right?
It's not a shared experience in the sense that the other API communities suffered equally, right. But there's a sort of a sense of complicity because, partly because of the sort of like the things happening overseas with the Japanese Empire, but a lot of Chinese Americans, Korean Americans, and Filipino Americans were very sort of like stridently had to distance themselves from the Japanese community, Japanese American community, and say, I would see buttons at the Nikkei sort of legacy center. There was an exhibit once that showed some of these buttons that said, I am not a Jap, or I'm like, no Japanese people here, from other Asian Americans, basically throwing, you know, that community under the bus. And just like, what is it about sort of like the, you know, complicated feelings and, you know, sort of needing to survive that, you know, my, you know, Filipino ancestors, not direct ancestors, but, you know, in the Filipino American community, that like they felt the need to kind of like have very strong feelings there.
Well, I mean, and I think the need to distance oneself is also because you know that it could be you.
Right.
Like it was a Japanese, but it could have been.
It's a tokenism.
It could have
been
any of us, you know, and I think through history, like now that we're a few generations later, you know, and like we no longer have to wear the buttons that say what you're not. I think that's what I mean, that just that sense that we can kind of do the Asian American thing and we can say like, oh, there's proof that, you know, there is racism towards the most model of modelless minorities here in this country and all that sort of stuff. So I just find it really fascinating here. You have like groups, even like Nono Boy, you know, are people who are two people who are trying to talk about their personal past. And but Julian Saporiti, the one, male standing voice on the album, he himself is actually Vietnamese American. And so it's kind of this interesting thing of like people pulling into that API history to, I don't know, kind of tap into the American experience.
Well, and also I should mention that it was through sort of like Neil's kind of rigorous research skills as a son of a librarian that I found out that, you know, the Canadian government had declared the Japanese Canadian community enemy combatants, like something like months before Pearl Harbor, which contradicts the narrative that we're told that happened in a response to Pearl Harbor. It was always kind of planned.
Both the Canadian and American governments were pre-World War II already conspiring to find some reason to... They had plans in place. And I remember as a high school student doing a research project on this and being appalled when I realized, you know, all the narratives I'd ever heard about Pearl Harbor and its, you know, being the reason for the internments were lies, that they had nothing to do with the actual facts. And that was deeply troubling. So I think that was the beginning of it. I think perhaps going back to your original question, what is it that draws us to research and to consider and ponder like these experiences? I think at the heart, it's the sense of betrayal, the sense that regardless of who we are and what we've done, that there are judgments being passed about the right or the privilege or the opportunities that we're supposedly have for being in the country. That, you know, and even saying like today that we don't have to wear badges that say, I am not a Jap, we do find the performance of patriotism at a, you know, it's an all-time high at this mm-hmm. point. It's like, it's a way of saying that you're safe. Mm-hmm. If you like sport a flag or if you do these different things, that it's almost, you have to like advertise in some ways that you deserve to be here. And in ways that we don't, you know, interrogate other people about.
Yeah.
So I think that's deeply troubling. I think part of my avenue into my continued interest into the period has to do with the ways it did impact individuals. And even, you know, sort of this idea of Japanese American literature being largely a response to the internment experience and, you know, its aftermath is also a way of obscuring, you know, those that preceded it and the complicated mm-hmm. experiences that they had. One of the historical figures I find deeply fascinating is Sadakichi Hartman, who's part German, part Japanese, mm-hmm. born in 1871, came over to the U.S. In the 1880s, or let's see, 1869. He came over in the 1880s, and
oh wow,
yeah, he was like 17, I think, when he came over, or younger than that. 15? Anyways, he was young when he came over, and he ended up becoming a writer and a critic and an artist. But he was part German, part Japanese. He lived all the way up until 1944. And here's a person who wrote the first history of American art, who was an inspiration for famous figures like Ezra Pound and Amy Lowell. And
oh, wow.
And contributed in major ways to the rise of the Imagist movement, and yet was largely erased at the end of his life because it was politically and socially inconvenient to be tied to someone who was both part German and part Japanese. And so they destroyed correspondence and denied him largely erased him from the records.
Wow.
But having a fascist Ezra Pound ranting about the U.S. government is okay, apparently.
Yeah.
It's okay for Pound to do that and simultaneously include Hartman in his cantos.
Wow.
America.
That's fascinating.
America.
Yeah. America. But things you can buy, Mike, we're going to transition to talking back about Neil. And we've been teasing this from the beginning of the episode. By the way, yeah, I'm noticing, oh my gosh, we're only in our last 15 minutes here. We got to hurry up and talk about the Babbage, about Neil's book. Neil, can you, you got a copy there?
Yeah, I do.
Is there a passage you might want to read for us?
Sure. I was like thinking about what to read, and I read a lot of these poems, but I'm going to read something here from Babbage, backstage at a performance of Don Giovanni, finds himself caught between heaven and hell. So Charles Babbage was a 19th century mathematician who designed, partially built, but never finished what would have been the first computer. So he was effectively 130 years ahead of his time. He was also a noted curmudgeon and definitely an engineer. So
I can identify with that.
Going to the opera, there's an anecdote that he tells about going to the opera and becoming more interested in the workings of the stage machinery than the actual performance.
Oh my gosh.
So he does end up going backstage, and this is kind of what transpires. Bored with the opera, you slip between the curtains to mingle with the movers of scenes. You ascend to the rafters, count the vents in the roof, the vast water tanks suspended, readied to drown the house should it erupt in flame. In the dark heavens, you wander the labyrinth of ropes and beams above the stage, a strange configuration of timbers and boards. You descend narrow steps, twist your path down into the pits below. Here three lamps blaze, making the obscure even more incomprehensible, a mad arrangement of teetering tables, each set to rise or fall with whatever transpires above. Now, as the bell chimes, a voice directs you towards a distant light, and you scramble, leaping to the platform rising before you, even as lightning flashes in a make-believe storm. Here, caught between two worlds, you are denizen of neither. The devils with forked tails riding with you cannot fathom how you came to be here, nor can you entirely. Beyond the trapdoor above you, the wicked Don Giovanni is being slain by a statue, the earth already roiling at his feet, and before all hell arises to take his soul, you must roll free. You must fly from here, your arms outstretched into the darkness, reaching for a single beam, for something to grasp onto, lest you arrive on the lighted stage, unbidden and unknown.
That's Babbage's Dream by Neil Akin, passage from your latest book.
Yeah.
And for those who are like, who is Charles Babbage? Let me say, that was my feeling at first when I met Neil. Because I was an editor for his podcast, The Lit Fantastic. And every once in a while, he would mention Charles Babbage. I was like, who is this man? So I did some wikiing and was absolutely fascinated with who this man was. And so, Neil, you actually, you weren't always a writer.
Mm-hmm.
This is second career for you?
At least,
you know, that's what we're all in life. Because you actually used to be a programmer.
I used to be a computer games programmer, and I worked in that industry for close to 5 years. Now, it sounds glamorous, but most of the time I was just implementing code and following, you know, functional specs written by other people, which is effectively to say other people design what the game is supposed to be, and then you try to make it happen, and you realize they have no idea how computer code works. And it's completely unrealistic. Or they don't understand what makes something fun, and you have to tell them, no, no one's going to like this. And they'll say, why don't you make it so we can see why it won't work? And you say, that's a whole extra week of labor that is going to be thrown away.
And so Neil took his experience in being a programmer, and you've written interesting poems and just, you know, have interesting opinions about, and it's such a beautiful, artistic, writery way of being able to describe what it is to be a programmer and to be talking about the all the sorts of topics. Because I find Babbage really interesting that he was the first person to build a computer, almost build a computer.
Yeah, I mean, he comes up with the architecture for how a computer works. He comes up with the stored memory program, the basically how the computer is divided internally in our modern computers. That's all his design. When in the 1930s, when they started working on the first digital computers, they came across his notes, and they realized that he had already addressed a lot of the same problems that they were grappling with in terms of how to like make machinery solve, how to break down problems into ways that a machine could solve, and he had addressed them.
Wow. And so how, for you in writing Babbage's Dream, I'm just sort of wondering, did you pick out Babbage beforehand? Like, how did you come to be fascinated by him? And then, like, this is a piece of fiction, correct?
So it's a book of poetry. So there's parts that are, I'll say it's historical poetry with interspersed with other pieces that are more contemporary or revolve around, like, famous artificial intelligences. But the Babbage thread through there is almost entirely based on actual historical record. And I guess going to, you know, trying to think where to go with that exactly. But basically, so he had these really fascinating, like the source material for me was largely his own memoir. He wrote a very detailed, interesting, and funny autobiography. And then just other contemporaneous, like, reports in, you know, so comments, letters by Darwin and Dickens and other people who were in his social circle that came to the parties at his house. This is something really weird to think of, that here is this technologist who ends up becoming the part of the social center and the fabric of London, that everyone, it was the who's who of the London literary and basically London intelligentsia would all descend on his home for these parties. So much so that Dickens, in one of his letters, Darwin, writes to his sister, who is coming to visit him in London, and says, you must come with me to Babbage's, one of Babbage's soirees, for there you will see the world, and he capitalizes world. And it's just like, it is, it's everyone.
It's funny as you're describing, because I was just thinking about, like, why in my mind did I think it was, like, fiction? It's because when I think of one of the Babbage stories, I don't think of Babbage as being someone who could possibly actually be a real person that existed, because of the story about him in the volcano.
Yeah.
That he, like, it's like, I'm going to lower myself into a volcano. And I don't think he was even doing well. Like this person
just seems
to me.
Larger than life.
Yeah, he's larger than life. And I'm like, clearly Neil would.
Clearly Neil made that up. There was some filling in the gaps.
There's this guy who's like, I think I'm going to make a computer and lower myself to a volcano. Like, he's just, he's fascinating.
Yeah, it would stand in heated rooms, in heated furnaces to test what the effect of, like, extreme heat would be on the human body.
And so he'd get ready to lower himself into this volcano.
And like, who conducts, like, surveys of the interior of volcanoes? Who does all these other ridiculous
so
things?
So it's just so fascinating. You know, you have the story that you're basically writing about this technologist who is, like, you know, before the time of computers, and yet he's still fascinating today.
Yeah. And I think a lot of it is just the idea. I mean, the title of the book comes from the fact that here's someone with a dream that's larger than a lifetime. That there's, and near the end of his life, he just realizes there's no way he's going to finish what he's working on. And yet he persists. He continues to work on it, even though the audience has disappeared, even though his supporters have kind of lost faith. He knows, and he writes in his autobiography, he says, some future generation will recognize what I've done.
I guess that's always the hope as an artist.
Yeah. It's a
complete artistry right there.
Yeah.
You know, we're out of time, and I want to make sure that we get in all the infos here. Thank you very much, Neil, for coming today and for sharing about your Decanon Visibility Project. If people want to visit the Decanon Library, where can they do that?
It's at 8155 Northeast Oregon Street in Portland, which is milepost 5 in the Art House Cafe space.
Cool. And if the Babbage's Dream, if they want to read that, how can they do that?
They can track it down on Amazon, or you can find it through, you can order it through me at www.neilaitken, that's neil-aitken.com.
And then you also got the Lit Fantastic here on KBOO Community Radio, which is the first Mondays of the month from 10 to 11.
10 to 11.
And then, Neil, you got so many things. So go check out Neil on the social medias. Go check him out on his website. Other stuff that we got coming up over the next couple weeks. Jake, you got White Noise coming up?
On October 10th. Yeah, yeah. We have a book release party for Ashley Tolliver for her new book, Spectra, coming out from Coffee House Press.
What time is that at?
That's at 6 p.m. at Midway Library. Out on 120 Southeast 122nd.
Nice.
And then Neil and I and a few other curators are organizing the East Portland Arts and Literary Festival.
The EPALF,
which is a POC-centered book fair and festival with main stage performances, stand-up comedy. We have Katie Wynn, Jen Tam, and Carlos the Rollerblader. We have a book release event for Dal Strong.
You guys have all the people.
And yeah, we have many other things.
So that's October 20th.
19th and 20th.
Oh, 19th and 20th.
At PCC Southeast.
So it's awesome. A little bit of everything for everyone. Come on down, everybody. And then we have...
The day after that, Intersect Fest.
We have Intersect Fest on October 21st, and that's at Pica. And then going back a couple days there on October 20th, we have Nono Boy playing again at Oregon Buddhist Temple, and that's at 7 p.m. You can check out all that stuff on the Facebooks as always. And to take us out, we're going to go listen to one more Nono Boy song, which is called Heart Mountain, which for Japanese Americans is not so heart, but important. Oh.
And also, really quick, there's a 4-week class that Neil is teaching at Literary Arts, and scholarships are available for POC and people who have income restrictions.
What's the class about?
It's a poetry manuscript workshop. So we'll just spend 4 weeks working through people's poetry manuscripts and getting them ready to send out.
Oh wow!
Just publish some books, people.
Yeah. Help Neil get past those gatekeepers and show everybody what's up. Okay, so we'll. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back on the fourth Friday at 11 a.m. with another Pacific Underground. Here is Nono Boy with Heart Mountain.
Good years on a mountain, primrose on the sill. Good years on a mountain, in the house.
that we build. Some star-crossed outlaw love in the movies is cool, but over and over our hearts are wrapped by the rules. Dream, do not do, don't dare drift from the pew. No serpent slain vinyl curtain, no Byronic review. Hush, hun, tell no one, this one's for you. Hush, hun, and hold it, trust it as true. Born to western mountains, three states from my hills. A long decade onward, great gap to fill of travel and reference, yet I imagine us still. Old queens in Okinawa, springs of sonnets fulfill. Hush, hun, and hold on, a daydream must do. Hush, hun, and hold.
As much as it pains us all to cut off such gorgeous harmonies, it's 10 o'clock on KBOO Portland, which means it's time for Valley Views. And as mentioned before, we're going to round out the hour with yesterday evening's flashpoints, generously shared with us by our siblings in struggle at KPFA in Berkeley, and we thank them for that. We'll round out the morning with a Radio Geekly at 11, reporting back from convention season and insight on spooky happenings to check out this fall. And make sure you're doing your part to maintain the one electronic media outlet in this area that makes space for this kind of programming. It's important to you. That's why you tune in. So make sure you do what's important to keep it available to you and all your friends and neighbors, people you've never met, and some people you